All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HITECH Annual Report Work Group. We will officially call the meeting to order, starting with a brief roll call. Carolyn Peterson?
I'm here.
Erin Meary?
I'm here.
Christina Caraballo?
I'm here.
Brett Oliver?
Here.
Chesley Richards? Okay, we'll circle back and see if Chesley joins a little bit later. With that, I will turn it over to our co-chairs to kick us off.
No problem. And so I want to thank everybody for joining the call. I know several of you have to go relatively soon. So we'll try to maybe go through this a little faster so we can get a bulk of the activities in and just sort of just refresh from previous discussions. Carolyn, anything you want to add to that?
I don't think so.
Okay, so let's go right into the meat of it. So we'll go ahead and go to the next slide. So as we had talked about what our scope was, really, you know, trying to look at and figuring out from based on what 21st Century Cures requires us to do, sort of the analysis, the assessment, looking at gaps, and so the ideas. We went through this in detail with the HITECH and got some great feedback. Next slide. So again, today we'll be kind of overview, sort of where we are from a progress perspective, is what our structure looks like. Then the landscape analysis, the gap analysis, recommendations for addressing those gaps, and then suggestions for the HITECH initiatives, along with all the supporting detail. The structure seemed to get a lot of approval from the HITECH. I think folks want some more detail in it, which we will go into some of those ideations as further along in this discussion. But this is kind of what we're looking at for an overall structure of the report. Next slide. All right, so let's look at the feedback from the committee discussion last week or so. Next slide. All right, so overall, the committee felt very comfortable with where we were going with things. Again, the structure made sense to folks logically. You know, it really was sort of an opportunity to discuss future state. A lot of very excited discussion around the table about what health IT could look like one day, which is always a fun thing to ideate on. Folks really wanted to focus in on measurement, you know, and as we had talked about on these calls, being the first time through, we really wanted to sort of talk through how do we set that watermark. And Carolyn did a great job of articulating that point of, you know, this is a way for us to really sort of throw a measurement in the sand and really for us to look at that as we further go on and see what we succeed in. So both realistic and sort of stretch targets, really sort of empirical measurements of achievement and really establishing that, and also future objectives, what will really move the needle. You know, there was a lot of discussion also on what had been done previously. And, you know, this is something I said on this call, which is I don't want to lose sight of the excellent work that some of the prior FACAs had done on the Standards Committee and the Policy Committee, and really being able to tether our current work to those iterations in the past gives a complete body of work, along with things that the ONC teams have done over the many years. We really want to address also a lot of definitions of what things like interoperability actually mean. As time goes on, these definitions evolve, so it's important for us to really be specific so that as we look back in later years, we know exactly what we were referring to when we were thinking about interoperability. And then, of course, some of the business impact to business models and provider efforts and those sorts of things, the shared data. I know, Brett, you had spoken up on this point about, you know, looking at overall, what does that mean for a clinician? And what does that mean as we go along the path of how this could affect positively or negatively clinician workflow? Next slide. So some themes that we wanted to talk about here, and so the HITECH, you know, looked at from a discussion on what interoperability actually means, and, you know, these are themes that, you know, we want to consider as we look at the various dimensions of how do we measure ourselves and what do we want to focus on in the future. And a lot of this really boils down to things you've seen in the news related to, say, like patient matching or standards or, you know, how, you know, health IT safety, such as opioid crisis, all the way through future items, such as, you know, where are we going with mobile devices and how is telehealth going to concern us in the future? And as we move the ball there, is that going to, you know, drive, you know, some concern or questions around business drivers and making sure that we realign those? So really looking at the unintended consequence of technology, perseverance, and adoption. And then, you know, again, what we talked about, what do we think of that interoperability state in that 1 to 10 to 5 years? You know, is that an appropriate timeline? Should we keep it at a more, you know, reasonable 2-3 years, or what does that look like? So, you know, overall, the HITACH is trying to look at this comprehensively, which I really appreciate and applaud, and trying to think of this from multiple dimensions and multiple actors. Next slide. All right. So, Carolyn, do you want to pick it up from here?
Sure. Let's go forward. So, just as a kind of a general overview in terms of what we're putting in the landscape analysis for the structure, looking at the legislative requirements, of course, that's what's in 21st Century Cures, as well as the current ONC and HITACH priorities. So we need to kind of be sure we cover all the things that the HITACH has done this year, as well as the work groups that are in progress and things that we're setting up to start in 2019. And then for each priority target area, we need to lay out the background and the current state. So we may need to describe some recent advancements for some of the topics and provide some examples from stakeholder groups. We had decided to include some examples at our last meeting because we felt like that can help make it clearer, for example, how a particular situation affects, say, payers or patients or some other of the stakeholder groups, you know, that we want to not forget in our analysis. The next slide, please. So we can start now into looking at some of these particular topics with regard to interoperability, you know, some of the current state topics and advancements, this existing exchange efforts between direct trust and HIEs, vendor networks, CCDA, and so forth. We've got ONC's proposed regulations covering open APIs, information blocking, and other health IT topics. We did get some more clarity around the information blocking earlier this week, so that's good to feel like we will definitely have something we can include in the report and not have to leave a space until the very last minute. The draft trusted exchange framework, standards and implementation specifications to support priority uses of health IT, so that would be the USCDI, the standards priorities, and then HL7's fast healthcare, interoperability resources, you know, FHIR standard for transferring electronic medical records. Next slide, please. So then this brings us to another topic, privacy and security, and some of the current state things we're thinking about, the OWASP 2.0 security profiles for authentication, privacy and security protections for patient-generated health data, remote monitoring data, you know, and other telehealth data, things that are happening outside the clinician's office or the institution. We've got user-controlled mental health and behavioral health information sharing. You know, this can include things like the interoperability frameworks, care quality, health IT activities that address opioid epidemic and social determinants of health, HHS Office for Civil Rights, Consumer and Provider Guidance for Mental Health and Behavioral Health, and then the SAMHSA Guidance for 42 CFR Part 2. These are some of the subpoints that we had discussed in our previous meeting. We should also probably do a mental check to be sure there's nothing else that we think needs to fit in this bucket, since we'll be getting into the writing shortly, and you know, it's good to get the planning out of the way first. Our next slide, please. And then continuing additional topics, privacy and security concerns that arise from increased health information sharing for research, things like Apple Research Kit, Patients Like Me, 23andMe, the new All of Us program. Think about improved patient matching and verification, PCOR patient matching, aggregating and linking projects, and then other things that we all may be aware of just in our own daily lives. And of course, disaster planning for health IT, the HIPAA security risk assessment tool. Next slide, please. So now we come to patient access to information. And again, some current state topics. We've got the Blue Button Initiative and My Healthy Data at CMS. Data collection using mobile and wearable devices. Something of relevance for us here could be the FDA pre-certification program. Use and sharing of PGHD. Again, we've got the ONC PCORE PGHD policy white paper with a practical guide and the patient engagement playbook, and then changes to current procedural terminology code set. These are some resources that we can mention. I don't know that there's perhaps a lot to be said about things that have been done in the past, like the playbook, but we definitely want to make sure people are aware of them by making that readily accessible through this report. Next slide, please. And then further use and sharing of SDOH data, you know, things like LOINC and efforts to address health inequities. And finally, emerging platforms for data sharing by patients and caregivers. And this could be things like the Apple Health Kit and OpenNote. Next slide, please. So do we want to stop right now, Aaron, or do you want to go through all the slides and then circle back?
We can stop right here if you want to. I think we keep going. We're just going to be talking to the group. So let's sort of talk and see if there's any questions first.
Okay. So questions?
Oh, okay. Let's keep going then.
Okay. Do you want to take the next section or do you want me to keep going?
Go ahead, and we'll just go halfway, and then I'll pick it up from the end.
Okay. We don't want to bore anybody with too much of one voice.
Right.
So here we've got the proposed gap analysis structure. And then for each of the priority target areas, gaps identified, opportunities identified, and then recommendations for addressing the gaps and opportunities. Well, let's go to the next slide. So again, with interoperability, some of the gaps that we identified previously is ongoing efforts regarding open APIs, information blocking, the TEF, and then the standards and implementation specifications. There's lack of knowledge about user experience of health information exchange. We've got unmet needs of these additional care settings and stakeholder groups. A delay in timeliness between issuance of guidelines and development of technology. The need to increase the level of interoperability. The need to improve data quality, provenance, and usefulness. And infrastructure needs of stakeholder groups, especially as they relate to broadband access. Next slide, please. There's some opportunities around interoperability. Establishing usability metrics for health information exchange. We had talked a bit about that at our recent in-person meeting with the HITECH, and this is definitely a concern and a priority for the full committee. Expansion of priority use cases to meet needs of additional care settings and stakeholder groups. Want to address alignment of timeliness of guidelines and development of technology. The incentives for change across stakeholder groups to improve the level of interoperability and data quality, and support for increased broadband access across stakeholder groups, especially with regard to underserved populations. That could be things like people living in rural areas or people in urban areas where perhaps the broadband access isn't so good or the infrastructure doesn't exist. The next slide, please. So coming to privacy and security, some of the gaps that we've talked about are the variability of information sharing policies across states, lack of knowledge about HIPAA and confidentiality with regard to substance use disorder patient records, the lack of user control sharing and disclosing information. Some of the implications of the European Union GDPR and the Privacy Shield. Also, implications of California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018 and, assumably, any other state laws that seek to do similar things. Widespread adoption of cybersecurity frameworks. And there's the lack of user awareness and education about privacy and security settings. and implications of emergence of the Internet of Things. What does that mean for people, and how will that affect healthcare and the kinds of things we need to do as a part of the formal healthcare structure, like exchanging information? The next slide, please. So here are some opportunities that we've identified related to privacy and security. We've got this increased uniformity of information sharing policies, education about HIPAA and confidentiality, some of those implications of the regulations, granular levels of consent to share and disclose information, addressing implications of the GDPR and the Privacy Shield. There's certainly been some uptake and some concern about that among industry. Addressing implications also of the California Consumer Privacy Act, support for widespread adoption of cybersecurity frameworks, education of tech users about these privacy and security settings, especially as they relate to social media. Consider what to regulate about the Internet of Things, and continue to improve patient matching when data is being shared. Next slide, please. So now we're coming to the patient access to information. Some of the gaps that the work group has identified so far is the lack of patient and caregiver access to patient data, the use and sharing of PGHD and other data that's coming from mobile devices, the need to improve alignment of timing of planning activities with the operational impact of tech development. There's the potential for lack of net neutrality due to market forces, unmet infrastructure needs for underserved populations, accessibility and usability of patient portals continue to need improvement, and patient awareness and education about health IT resources, you know, in particular the things that ONC can help people find their solutions. On the next slide, please. So here are the opportunities that relate to those gaps. Can support use of APIs to improve access to patient data. Consider the workflow and technology improvements to increase the use and sharing of PGHD and other mobile data. We can better align timing of planning activities with operational impact. Consider the implications of varying experiences with net neutrality at the local, state, and national level. And support infrastructure needs for underserved populations. And consider improvements to accessibility and usability of patient portals. And I would argue as well other interfaces that people are using quite regularly through their healthcare. And patient and caregiver education about health IT resources. The next slide, please. So now we come to the recommendations for addressing gaps and opportunities. And that is part of what we want to determine today.
Carolyn?
Yep.
This is Christina. Before we move on, there was just one note I had. Under the interoperability gaps, we didn't put patient matching and identification management or identity management. We had it under the opportunities under privacy and security, but we might want to just add that to interoperability as well.
Yep, that sounds like a great idea. So,
what about you?
Yeah. So how do we want to start out with this section? What are you thinking, Aaron?
Well, I mean, we can go back and sort of talk through and kind of do what Christina's talking about, like just ideate on various items here. You know, I also want to give the group a chance to think about it offline if necessary and email in further ideas. But I guess I would ask, does anything jump out as an obvious? Maybe we can go back one slide to rejigger everybody's memory. All right, let's see here. Right, so, you know, and looking at it, you know, our question that we had here our question that we had here was to really start thinking about the complexity of from a patient access to information. You know, what is that? What are all the different dimensions that are keeping patients from being able to really be engaged? I mean, this could go a zillion different directions, but to the degree of it, it's, you know, what can the high tech do to help further along, you know, the consumer population to want to access their data? Is it make it easier with, you know, technologies like what Apple's doing or others? Is it a more prevalence of maybe reimbursement changes to allow for this? What do we need to do? Because I can tell you that as I put my hospital CIO hat on, you know, just getting patients to sign up for a portal just to make meaningful use was a bear in itself. So now having them be able to access their data appropriately and ubiquitously is that much more of a higher bar. So what can we do? So we'll start thinking of it that way. You know, I'd be curious, Brett, from a clinical perspective, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, exactly, Aaron. I think the value of their own data, if we could come up with sort of examples of use cases to make it important to them, if that makes sense, why would I care? You know, the doctor's going to call me with my labs or the nurse will let me know what that value was. Why should I care? And to help educate them on sort of the coming wave of applications that will be able to apply things that we're not even doing now to that data. But again, I think just a gap would be the understanding of what this could do for them.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thought. That's a very good thought. Okay. Just thinking through that right now. Carolyn, I know you have a lot of experience with the various dimensions with from a patient perspective. You know, how do we begin to measure this? I guess is my question. What would be a smart, give an example of a smart metric related to patient access? Is it number of patients that were able to interact with the clinician, like Brett's bringing up? And what are you thinking?
I think, certainly years ago when we were getting started, the notion of getting people to sign up for a portal, you know, was sort of the first obvious metric. I agree with Brett that it's a challenge for one thing, and honestly, if someone signed up and they never use it, you know, the fact that they signed up is kind of irrelevant, not very helpful in terms of thinking about improving care. At the same time, I can see where for a hospital or another institution, you know, trying to measure portal use over time and quantify who's using it and come up with what's a meaningful level of use. You know, is it logging in twice a year? Because some people really don't need to go to the doctor or don't go often, even if they do need to. So there are fewer opportunities. In some sense, I almost wonder if it's more helpful to measure the time that the portal was online was working properly. Because the people who do want to use it, you know, if the system isn't working right or there's a lot of downtime, then that's another barrier for their intended use.
That's a good point. You know, one of the things that I'm just thinking of real-world examples, you know, when we stood up, I've led a couple of organizations, but it almost seems like every time I stood up a portal and I started interfacing with lab results or x-ray or even like discharge information, invariably I always had patients call back in saying, what does this actually mean? What do you mean that my, you know, XYZ value is XYZ? And so it almost had to be like reconnect them with a clinician to explain what they're actually reading. There wasn't a way to actually, for them, in English, to understand in layman's terms what they were actually seeing. So I'm just pontificating here. Is there value in showing a sort of that clinical validation that, yep, the patient understood that their, I don't know, potassium levels are high or whatever, you know, what is it, what do we need to actually move the needle, going back to what the high tech brought up the other week, you know, what are those relevant measurements to show patient sort of engagement? What do you think?
I think it's, for one thing, it's really hard to get through to your doctor to have your doctor explain the results, and that's maybe not necessarily in all cases something that's appropriate? I mean, certainly if you had some kind of test that's going to determine whether you have a particular type of cancer, or, you know, narrow down the diagnosis to the point where you know you need scans or something else, that's probably an interaction where you do want to be talking with your doctor. But if it's something like routine blood levels that you have checked every so many weeks or months, and it's just a matter that you need to know, yeah, I'm doing a good job, or no, they're too high, I need to grind down on it some more, you know, in that case, perhaps the best use of time and resources is to have an institutional person who follows up with those kinds of inquiries and can say, yeah, you know, this is what it was, and what it means is you got to keep working on it, or no, it's fine, everything's great, good job. But then you get into the human factors and organizational issues of, will all providers feel comfortable with someone explaining test results to their patients, even though they know that it's hard to find time to do that?
Right.
Yeah, even what's allowed by different state medical boards, too, you start running into those issues.
Yep.
It's tough because there's so many different workflows in giving lab results back. I mean, I've been doing this for 20-plus years. When I first started, it was very common for physicians to just say, we're going to check these tests, and you name it, fill in the blank, and we'll let you know if anything, if you don't hear from us, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that just made me nervous as a cat, quite frankly. Well, what if I never see the result? Where's the fallback on that? And so since that time and the litigious society that in which we live, that's changed. And so even though we're going to post your labs on MyChart for us, our portal, you're still going to hear from us about those labs. It's interesting, Aaron, that you had that experience that you were getting a lot of callbacks, because that's definitely been a physician pressure point or anxiety about giving patients access to more information. Well, I'm just going to be spending more time explaining these trivial things that don't mean anything. And that's not been our experience. Now, again, maybe if you've got workflows where you're calling them and it's just the portal is more of a resource that they can refer to, or in there with another clinician who doesn't have access to those labs, they can pull them up. But you know, also use of the portal, there's kind of two levels of it. You've got those that signed up before that were sort of early adopters of our first portals, and they're almost the harder ones to get re-engaged because it just wasn't all that useful for them. And now we've got all this new functionality. We can do video visits and interact with your clinician, this and that. They're almost the harder ones to sell than the second group that never signed up for that early round and that get in and say, wow, this is fabulous. I can, you know, this is much more than what I thought. It's not a list, not just a listing of my labs. So I'd want to think about how we can, what's the metric to use that, you know, meaningful information is being exchanged. That's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, Brett, I think that's a really good point. I think we need to focus less on how many times I log into the portal and more on what's available to me when I log in. So what features are there? What tools enable me to interact with my data? Is the information that I want available to me when I log in so that it's meaningful to me? How many points of access does a patient have? If we could measure that, that would be great. And when I'm thinking about that, I'm wondering, like, exactly how many portals do I have to log in to get my information from all different places? We've identified that as an issue, but can we, in this work, like, really paint that picture so that we can move more to a place where I'm able to use less a single portal and use APIs to be able to have different tools and places that I interact where all my information comes into one place. I think that's where we're going to start to make an impact, and less on just measuring simply logging into a portal.
Great points.
Yeah, I agree.
Great point. Okay. So what if we took the opportunity then to kind of think about this on the side, some specifics, and then, you know, over the next week or so, let's email in and maybe we could ask, you know, I don't know if there's a way for us to – I just feel like this topic is so important as we move the ball forward that it may be even worth, you know, posing it out also to the HITACH and see their thoughts are – on different dimensions for patient engagement, patient access, that sort of thing. I don't want us to I don't want us to get caught up in the whole trap of exactly what happened before, which is just how many people sign up for a portal, because all of you are exactly correct. It was just that's a very basic model for measuring. It really doesn't move the ball forward.
I agree with you, Aaron. I think that's a good approach.
Okay. Carolyn, should we move forward or should we continue to think through this?
I'm just looking at this list and trying to think about anything else. In the fifth bullet point, there's this mentioning of the supporting infrastructure needs for underserved populations. Are there other thoughts related to underserved populations or other things we can be thinking about? You know, we talked about, you know, bandwidth access. What else should we be thinking about? That perhaps saying something about availability of telemedicine consults or supporting infrastructures that can expand processes around telemedicine into areas where they don't exist now and would be useful.
That's true. I think when I think of infrastructure, I think of physical construct, right? So is there cable literally in the middle of nowhere to allow for people to get high-speed internet, you know? But I guess to your point, we could tie infrastructure also back to use case. So, you know, is telemedicine available for a rural part of the country due to a lack of physical cable plant or something to that effect?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that we can avoid getting stuck in the box of terminology where it's like, well, that's not strictly infrastructure, so it's not going to get recognized as a need or an opportunity, you know, because it's great to have the physical infrastructure, but if the resources haven't been allocated or there are laws or, you know, we've always done it that way that prevent useful things from happening, then that's something to think about too, because it's still a barrier for the patient and the provider.
Good thought. That's a good thought. You know, Brett, from a clinical perspective, if you're engaging with a patient that lives in a very rural part, what are some of those common headaches that you run into? Is it simply, you know, go to your local, you know, CVS to pick up a med, and there's no CVS nearby? I mean, what is it that drives you nuts to the clinician for your sort of your underserved patients that you see?
You know, in our organization, we do have fairly substantial rural population in the eastern part of our state, well, in western as well, but eastern is what I'm more familiar with. And it's probably the internet access, being able to deliver the same care, not as much telemedicine, which is certainly the future and I want to. It's actually just even running clinics. We have, say, for instance, remote cardiology clinics where, you know, the staff and the cardiologists will go, yet they can't even log into our EHR from where they are because they don't even have there's not even cell phone signal from where the clinic is. So, yeah, you've got a whole spectrum of infrastructure needs. You know, it's not just, well, they don't have access to internet at home because they can't afford it. It's not even available. And even in the towns where they're, you know, they're having the clinic, they're not even going to their homes and, you know, finding out they don't have internet access or cell service. So that's probably the biggest one. I think also with this big push towards having information in sort of a portable manner with devices, it's, even though the iPhone and Android and things are becoming ubiquitous, we still have a pretty large percentage that, you know, don't have a cell phone or have a flip phone. And so they don't have, you know, I think would sort of identify that as another gap for patient access information. They don't have the tool with which we're pushing things toward, for instance, you know, Apple Health Record. Yeah, you know, maybe they can go online, but if they don't have a phone, they likely don't have a computer. And again, even if that infrastructure is in place for the internet. Pharmacy-wise, Aaron, to answer that specifically, that's not most all the pharmacists are connected. I can at least e-prescribe that way. I rarely run into that problem. A bigger issue from that is when I discontinue a medication. There is a charge. I can enter in, you know, oh, this blood pressure medicine, you come back in a week, and you know what, it gave me a cough, we need to change that. I'll change it, and I'll also discontinue via the same system, but there is one out of 1,500 plus pharmacies in the state of Kentucky that has that functionality turned on because there is a charge of 25 cents, 50 cents to have that prescription functionality turned on. So the pharmacist, and they have no, you know, they're there to fill medications. There's no motivation, you know, to pay extra to make sure this gets turned off. So there are some technology issues, and I probably got sidetracked a little bit on that, but they're not, I don't think it's patient access for this particular gap analysis that we're looking at.
Yeah, but you know what? You just brought up an excellent, excellent point, and you're right. Even in Texas, you know, we have a disparity when it comes to being able to do something like, to your point, like e-prescribe and costs, and these costs of exchange and these costs of information access. And quite frankly, there's certain populations that simply can't afford it. They just can't afford it. And there's certain, you know, pharmacies that are out there, the mom and pop ones in very rural parts that just can't afford it. You know, so, you know, Carolyn, this may be something for us to consider and look at is, you know, the implications of the varying costs of infrastructure in, you know, underserved populations. You know, so not just is the cable plant or, you know, cell signal there, but are the costs in alignment with what that underserved population can afford, or something to that effect.
Yeah, that's a really big point. We've been talking about it in terms of the rural context, but just sitting here thinking about, say, a person who can't drive anymore, and they've, for health reasons or whatever else, they've kind of been becoming more isolated from, you know, their friends and the broader social group they had 5 or 10 years ago. You know, even for that person, having some kind of a telehealth or some sort of in-home link to providers would be beneficial in the same way that it benefits the rural person, because they struggle to get out and get to the clinic or to the pharmacy to pick up prescriptions or whatever else.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Okay, I want to marinate on this one a little bit more. I just think there's a lot of items here that it's worth us calling attention to, and it is impacting care. Let me ask a quick question here in general. Do we save the chat and public comments for the end? Is that how this works, Lauren?
We currently have it scheduled for, I believe, 12:20, or, you know, like
okay.
10 or 15 minutes before. So. We can just hold until then.
Perfect. Okay, I just want to make sure we don't lose sight, because I see a public comment here. I just want to give it respect. So we'll address that question at the end there. Okay.
What about the thought, and I'm not sure where this would fit in terms of a gap, but what I'm seeing happen as we continue to sort of flounder with national standards for interoperability, the capitalistic model in which we live, which I fully support, but is the monetization of this data. I don't even know if that's the right term, but I get vendors all the time coming to me and saying, hey, your ER physicians need this, this, and this. We can package that and sell it to you, essentially. That they have a slicker presentation than I just said, but I can see that really leading to gaps in information. You know, my hope is that there's as free exchange of information as possible, understanding I don't live in utopia and there are costs to some of these infrastructure changes, but do we see that as a potential gap that maybe we don't have now because the gaps exist, but as these companies start closing the gaps but at a price, does that lead to problems?
Good question. So basically, to paraphrase, you're asking the question as there's more data liquidity, and therefore, there's more valuation to that data because now we can extract more meaningful bits of information. Will organizations hold it hostage, essentially, for purposes of monetization? Is that what you're asking?
Well, not necessarily hold it hostage, but there's a cost to what this company's going to do. If there's a spaghetti network of piecing together all the information that I need, and I'll use the emergency room as an example. So they would want to see the PDMP data when you show up with some acute pain complaint, maybe any recent ER visits that I don't, you know, that not part of my system that I don't have easy access to. And there are companies that are out there now packaging that and saying, we will we'll run a query as soon as the patient hits your door. We'll have an interface with your system, and we'll run the query, and we have this way of pulling all this information and putting it in a package for you. And that, because of the spaghetti network of interoperability that we have now, or the lack thereof, I can't do that simply on my own. Well, there's a charge to that. And so will there be some emergency rooms then? Well, I'm an independent hospital. I can't do that or choose not to. And then there's a gap because of the delay of a national standard or what have you. Does that make sense? I'm not saying they're intentionally holding it hostage. They're just going about saying, hey, we can provide you this service. And not everyone's going to be able to afford that service if there's not a higher level of interoperability that they're able to get that information from.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That does make sense. I'm just trying to think, how would we measure that? What would be that? What would you think
mind? It's a good point. I'm not sure it's measured, but I thought it might be something we could call out as a potential gap.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's definitely worthwhile mentioning. Absolutely. I'm trying to also say, is there even a component of that we could measure? Because I do think there's an issue that's occurring, and it's also going to brew to get bigger, which is, you know, there are types of companies and types of organizations that do hold the data hostage because there's a valuation they place on it, right? I mean, and that's the reality of it, like claims data. You know, for various clearinghouses, they will not share that data unless you pay a premium for it, and or you have to subscribe to some service they offer because they are monetizing that, and that is their business model. So how do you free the data without disrupting business models, you know, and how do you measure that?
Yeah, no, it's a good point.
Okay, let's see. What else? Carolyn, what else on here do we want to talk to?
Is there anything that we haven't considered specifically relevant to APIs? I'm trying to think. Nothing's hitting my mind, but certainly that.
No, I think the ONC, especially, I've seen Dr. Rucker and Tima Verma and others have done such a great job of localizing APIs in the recent news that I think everybody's talking about it now versus a couple of years ago, no one even knew what it was. So I know the culture is moving in the right direction of using APIs. And I know the vendors are starting to listen, which is really positive. So everything is, in my mind, I look at it going, great, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to get there to where the highways are built to share data. I don't know if there's a way, how do we measure that? Should we measure it in terms of, you know, meaningful data is exchanged via API, certain types of data. I don't know. How do we measure usage of APIs?
I'm not sure that that's even a good use of time at this point. Perhaps when some particular uses of APIs have been identified,
right,
or risen to the surface.
Right.
I was kind of thinking in general, have I seen any particular legislation or initiatives or whatever related specifically to this in the last, say, 6 to 9 months, you know, where that there should be some thinking about what that means operationally. But honestly, I'm not coming up with anything. So if no one else,
the last legislation I saw referencing APIs was 21st Century Cares, where they literally call it out. And I did a big cheer when I read that. So I haven't seen anything recently, but I'm sure there's things coming.
Okay. And then accessibility and usability are always ongoing challenges. And I mean, there's W3 guidelines. But again, I'm not sure how HITACH or ONC are in a position to do something about that beyond stating the importance of continuing to push for improved usability and accessibility.
Right.
Should we go to a different subject beyond other than patient access?
Yeah, let's move forward. Let's keep going.
Okay. Which one do we want to go to now?
Interoperability or privacy security, I'm good with either.
Yeah, let's go to interoperability. That's a big one.
Okay, so do we think there's anything missing off of this slide, I guess is the first question, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, usability metrics, which I think there's a recommendation here in our public comments we can talk about later. You know, expansion of the use cases, alignment of timeliness, incentives for change, and then, again, back to that broadband access. And I'll be, you know, being perfectly candid here, I feel like there's an obvious item here that, for whatever reason, is not coming to my mind that we may be missing. But I can't seem to see it, but I'm looking at this slide going, I know there's something here that we haven't just brought up yet. It feels like there's something missing.
When we have the summary for the HITECH meeting, we can go back through the comments about that discussion and see if there's anything there that we haven't gotten on the slide.
Yep.
That was quite a long, detailed discussion. We may
it was
pull some things out of the notes on that.
I mean, we even talked about, you know, leveraging, you know, standards like OAuth 2.0 and others, you know, standardizing across, you know, various USCDI kind of, you know, nomenclature, you know, all sorts of things. Okay. Is there anything clinically, Brett, that you think from a clinical perspective that, you know, we should really hone in on when it comes to interoperability? And again, think of it in the terms of how can we measure too. What would you look for?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think this is a good outline. The biggest problem that we experience right now is just CCD information, believe it or not. You know, these are certified systems, but this data point is not mapped to this other data point, and there's literally not a way to do it without a separate interface. So when you're trying to do clinically integrated networks and the docs just to get them a CCD, that data has been a real challenge and not one I anticipated having. I thought we were past that, but clearly I was naive.
Yep, I've seen that too. Good point. Do you have the debate? Let me ask this question, because this is also, I think, relates back to interoperability and could relate back to patient access as well. Brett, have you had the debate in your organization about how much of a CCD to actually give the patient on discharge? So do you give them everything, or do you give them just like the summary and discharge notes?
You mean like after a visit or after a hospitalization?
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably some of the demographic exchange is probably not there that you would see just on standard CCDA material. It's tried to be a little bit more clinically relevant to them, you know, with patient instructions, but certainly, you know, the tests that they've had done, medications have been prescribed, diagnoses. I don't think we would have things like, you know, allergies and their address, follow-up appointments, things like that are happen at discharge. But some of those things are not even on our USCDI roadmap yet.
Got it. I'm just thinking in my head, is there a measurement for interoperability here based upon a standard criteria set that the patient gets every single time, you know, which would come from multiple systems, obviously, to be interfaced back out. So I'm just trying to think outside the box here. Are there other dimensions here to look at so we can say, hey, yep, check the box, this was measured, and then we can have a statistic measurement for it?
If we could just, you know, if we could certify these EHRs, if they're saying they're interoperable with each other at just the basic CCDA information level when they're truly not, you know what I mean? I feel like mm-hmm. these smaller practices, they took their federal money, they did their best in terms of vetting the EHR, they're certified, they can exchange data, and then they sign up for our clinical integrated network, and we can't get the data. Well, they don't have the resources, and quite frankly, for dozens of practices, we don't either, to then go and reinvent the wheel and figure out how we're going to get their data into our data so we can aggregate, you know, report on, et cetera. So, I mean, the metric of true CCDA information exchange, if that was able, that'd be a great starting point just to prove that they're actually able to do that.
I like that. So maybe under that first bullet point, we have a sub-bullet with that. Can you exchange CCDA data? I don't want to say the word meaningfully because I feel like that word's been burned out over the years, but meaningfully with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, just a true exchange of those 22 data points or whatever we decide on USCDI. Because it's not accurate. It's almost like saying, well, we exchanged information, and I've probably used this example before, but it's an ADT notification that someone was somewhere. Well, I mean, I guess at some level that's important, but if I don't have any information about that visit, it's really not moving the clinical needle. So you can say, oh, yeah, with certain systems we can exchange the CCDA information, yet if you can't do it universally and there's not a universal way of doing it, this is not like we have Epic. We're an Epic shop. It's not that Epic can't do it. It's just however this information is presented, and forgive me for not understanding the technical pieces to it, but it's not the same, and we can't make it the same. And in my mind, the CCDA is there's these very prescribed bits of information that should all be in the same format, and they're not. And somehow, you know, we've sort of let that slip the cracks in terms of certifying. Because that, from a clinician standpoint that doesn't have an IT background, you tell me my EHR is certified and can exchange information like that, then I'm looking at my bigger organization saying, what's your problem? My guy says he can do it.
Good point. Very good point. Carolyn, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I agree. That makes good sense to me. The gap between what we think we have and what we actually can use is often an issue underlying a lot of these things.
I like Brett's way of saying that. It's almost like a disparity between certified and reality. So I don't know how you. I'm not a wordsmith by any stretch of the means, but you know that measurement, that gap measurement as to, you know, yes, we check all the boxes and so we got certified against criteria, but it doesn't mean a can of beans to the clinician because it doesn't actually function in the real world setting. So that gap, I don't know how we word it, but that I like that.
I would just call it the reality gap, honestly. Maybe that's a new term that we contribute to the discussion. But you know, it's the operationalization, the difference between what you say you've got, what you should have theoretically, versus what actually plays when you plug it in.
That's exactly right. I like that. The reality gap. All right, trademarked. We're going to start using that. I like that. Okay, so we're going to add that as a sub-bullet then, under this first bullet item then, as a usability metric, the reality gap. And we can think through exactly how we do that, whether it's just looking at, we'll start with a CCD, or we'll start with some other measurement criteria. We can talk through it with the high tech, but I think, A, it meets a lot of the needs I'm hearing from my clinicians, like Brett's saying, which is, this is garbage, Aaron, what's going on here? And then B, as a CIO, when I go back to the vendor and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? Like, well, we're operating within normal operating parameters. So I like that. We call it the reality gap. We could begin to call attention to this, which is we really need to talk about this.
Yeah, it's the perception of what the average person would expect certification to mean and the reality of what it means.
Very nice. Okay. That goes on this. I like this a lot. That's a great topic. Okay. Carolyn, do we want to go through each one of these, or should we just keep talking? What do we think?
We're just about at the top of the hour, so we've got the public comment coming up in about 25 minutes. Are there any other, we probably should go look at privacy and security and be sure we don't overlook that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we can further fruit on the interoperability with privacy and security. Okay, have a little fun with this section. So in talking through this, you know, sort of the general thematic issues here, you know, what does it really mean now that, you know, companies like Apple have a band on a watch that can send you back an ECG? You know, what does it mean that, you know, states like California are passing, you know, IoT bills and consumer privacy acts and things like that? You know, what does it mean that GDPR is in play and, you know, actually the EU is passing even further legislation related to GDPR, you know, here in the very near future? So how does that all affect us and that discrepancy, again, that gap? Are there other items around privacy and security? And let's be a little more, maybe more granular. Are there items around privacy and security that maybe, Brett, you're hearing from patients as they come in, or, you know, others that you know, could affect us? Is it the temperature of the breaches that have been occurring recently and folks now being reluctant to do anything electronically? I don't know. Let's talk through it. You know, are there other items here that we want to talk through that are opportunities from a private security perspective?
You know, I haven't found, at least I'm probably speaking way too much of just myself because I haven't queried like the organization and my colleagues, but I haven't found my patient to be particularly bothered by that. You know, it's almost like it's happening somewhere else on a national level, or maybe they're not putting it in context. I do think that the fact that their data, like let's use the Apple Health Record on your iPhone, let's consider that may not fall under HIPAA. And so we've had to be really clear, because we do participate with it as an organization, that you're leaving, and this data, once it leaves, we're not responsible for it, you know, protecting it. And is there a good understanding? I think there's a pretty big gap of understanding. Like, everyone knows that when they see me and they tell me something, or we have a lab value that's sensitive, it's, you know, there's laws around that. I'm not, you know, revealing that even to your spouse without written consent. So is there that same understanding? And I would say no, with this new wave of hitting, of pulling your data out into an app or something along those lines, that may or may not. I'm not sure I understand the laws well enough to know what protects that or what doesn't. But we had to be sure we were clear as an organization to the patients. There's a big disclaimer before you sign up for Apple Health Record. Through my chart for us is, this is not our thing. They're asking for your data, not us, and we don't know what they're going to do with it, kind of thing. I think there's a gap there, at least.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that kind of goes back to that third from the last bullet, that education around privacy and security, you know.
Yeah.
And although this is not social media, this is consumer health media. What does it actually mean? You know, do people actually understand what they're consenting to? Because, I mean, make no mistake about it, you know, companies like Amazon and Apple and others do a phenomenal job with the data, but they take that data and do a zillion things with it. You know, are you consenting to that? Or do you realize what you're consenting to? It's a very good point.
And honestly, it's a gap for me personally, is understanding what does HIPAA cover in that regards or not, or whatever, you know, the corresponding regulations.
And if you had a question, who would you go to? Would you go to the OCR? Would you go to the FDA? Who would you query?
Yeah, great point.
And all of those issues will just multiply and blossom if additional states start passing legislation similar to that California Act. And then you have differences among states, and what happens when an organization works in multiple states and you potentially have information crossing state lines. I mean, you could just legislate certain solutions, like the laws that apply are the ones that were in effect in the state where the data was created, but we don't have those today. Probably won't for a while. Might be hard to ever get there, depending on, you know, politics and just the realities of different stakeholder needs and goals.
Yeah, that Carolina.
You're exactly right.
I don't know anything about the California law, but all I thought was, oh my gosh, now we're going to have 50 of those things. federal regulations, and how in the world are we going to keep track of all of that?
It'll keep developers busy, that's for sure.
That's true. Hey, Aaron, I'd like to bring something up under here that you mentioned, and it was really not during this meeting, but back when we had our face-to-face meeting, and it was really under future things to talk about, but I wonder if under privacy and security it fits here in terms of I don't know if it's a gap, but there certainly doesn't exist right now. The safe harbor principle, it is very frustrating to, as an organization, work really hard, pour tons of resources, time, money, effort into bringing your security levels up. You never go to zero, or you never get to a four, whatever your scale is, and have parameters and standards set for your vendors. But if the vendor has a breach, it's your patient data that's lost. You're responsible, and I really thought quite a bit on that after you mentioned it at the meeting. And is a lack of some kind of safe harbor or floor standard nationally, is that something that we should call out?
You are exactly right, and I can tell you I've had this debate with numerous legislators and various federal officials, and there are a variety of thoughts on it. You know, how do you, and it boils down to this one basic premise. If you set a floor, are you inadvertently legislating how a company should build its products? And the government obviously doesn't want to be in the business of telling a private business how to conduct their business. But to your point, are we at a tipping point as a vertical that we do need a minimum floor, and to the point of what I brought up during the high tax, therefore some sort of safe harbor for organizations to say, hey, look, I've done my very best and stuff still hit the fan. You know, don't come after me like I'm negligent. You know, let's work together to help me get better, whatever it is. I think that's a worthy discussion point. I have seen a lot of voluntary standards coming out recently, especially I've seen the FDA did a really good job when it comes to medical devices and at least starting to set up these parameters of following the NIST cybersecurity framework and others. But there hasn't been I'll use the word mandatory floor or framework adoption. I know that at some point, and Carolyn, keep me honest here, we talked about frameworks and looking at that and adopting a framework. Oh, there it is. I see it right there. Fourth bullet point from the bottom there. Maybe we could use the sub-bullet as to talk about, you know, the potential for additional safe harbor considerations for following a specific framework. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
That's an interesting idea.
Guidelines. Yeah, some guideline that you could follow. And even we're still responsible. We still want to figure out how to make the system better, but something that you could defend yourself with, saying, listen, we were at this level 2 national recommendation. That should count for something. We can't know. We do due diligence with our vendors. We have certain parameters that you have to reach, but we're not in their offices. We're not with their servers, you know. Especially as we move more to cloud-based things, it concerns me that our vulnerabilities increase without the ability to be sort of on-site and protecting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And I mean – well, the business associate agreement, you know, assuming you've done one, which if you haven't, do it, with every one of your vendors, is in place. That's supposed to give you a level of cover. However, to your point, the data is still breached. There's still other questions that could come up and or further, investigation that could occur. So is there additional safe harbor considerations there? I think that's a really interesting point, and I would love to. I know we had talked about maybe talking to other agencies at some point in the future. That'd be a great question to pose and see how that would work. Because I honestly don't know the back-end operations of that, but I think it's an interesting question we should ask.
Is it something that we would want to park on like a list of emerging issues? You know, we've sort of thought in terms of gaps and opportunities and things that we clearly see on the horizon, but then there are other things where you think, well, if this and this happens, or in 6 months we might have enough experience to know about this, you know, are there things that we should be thinking about and revisiting, say, second or third quarter of 2019?
Yeah, I like
I don't want to say parking lot, because sometimes the parking lot turns into the junkyard and things that go there never leave. But, you know, we're clearly thinking two or three steps ahead, and maybe it's good to gather those ideas into a list where they can be acknowledged as medium-term upcoming things to think about or revisit.
I think that's a very fair point. I like that. I do like that. I do have one item, though, I have on this list, on my list here, that I want to talk about maybe more near-term. So it wouldn't be for a parking lot, but something for us to consider here. There is this notion of accountability that's beginning to come up from a privacy security perspective as to, you know, if accountability is to be held, who is accountable? And I think this kind of goes back, Delta Brett, to what you were bringing up here a moment ago, which is, you know, we have all these different groups leveraging data. Say it's Aaron's data, right? And I have interacted with, say, 10 different systems and vendors, and then, of course, the provider organization to see my lab results. I'm making this up. If that data is compromised or breached or modified or whatever, who is accountable? Because there's so many intersecting points. So to me, there needs to be a level of, okay, who really is Johnny on the spot? Because today, when there's even a question of, say, there's a technical issue, there's a lot of finger pointing because so many different groups, you know, intersect. So there's not really a level of clear accountability. So I think there is a value point for us to talk through here under privacy and security and say we need to hold or have clear delineated roles of accountability when it comes to privacy and security. What are your all thoughts?
It could be a really useful task to come up with a chart that, you know, it could be a work product perhaps of a small subgroup or of the full HITACH. You know, if this is the issue, here's the party to be accountable, and here's the party to be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we can sort of talk through these things with some degree of confidence, but certainly for consumers or perhaps for physicians who've observed or other providers, you know, in a large system who've observed what they think was some problem or issue related to the technology, it could be really helpful in terms of helping people pinpoint, who do I talk to? Where do I raise the flag? You know, what can I expect in terms of who I'm working with? And, you know, where do I go if I don't see that that's ever been acknowledged or considered?
Exactly. And I know that I keep going back to this FACA, because the OCR was really involved and did a great job with us. But on the API FACA, they did a great job of doing some sort of accountability matrix when it came down to HIPAA. And what third parties are responsible under HIPAA and which ones weren't. It's almost like the next generation of that chart, which is, okay, so now that we have that component, when it comes to dealing with EPHI, where is the accountability as you deal with, you know, multiple things now with a health kit or whatever else? You know, who's accountable? Because when Brett goes to, you know, sign up, you know, a new patient under health kit and is explaining to them, he could point to a chart of the clinician and go, look, you know, my organization is not responsible. This is the responsible party. It is, I'm going to just make this up, Apple or whomever, you know, just so you're clear on it. Because I think today, he brought this up, that people just don't know.
Yeah, and even gets more granular than that. What's the accountability for the person receiving the information? I know we're kind of talking more organizationally, leakage and breaches and things like that, but if we start providing more information than we would hope that would be good, what's, as a provider, what's my accountability for that information? Now, if I requested it, I ordered it, I asked for, it's mine. But if there's a lot of automation to some of this, like all of a sudden I get, you know, mammogram reports on things, on mammograms that I didn't order, maybe it's not even my patient, it just got sent to me inadvertently, what's my accountability? I hear that. That's a huge stressor for my colleagues, is I didn't ask for that information. I don't want it. They don't want to sign off on it. They don't want to say, you know, because they're afraid it's a 50-page report and I don't have time to read it all. What if there's something in there that implicates me? I'm not even seeing the patient for that. So there's accountability on another level as well. And again, that may be put it in the junkyard parking lot, whatever, but it just was brought to mind as you guys were talking.
Great point. That's a great point. And it's all of that, right? So how do we begin to quantify and qualify accountability on all dimensions, both local and granular and an organizational perspective? I think that's an excellent item. And we can start very simple. When I look at measurements of that, I mean, it's simply, you know, do you have all of your data identified? Do you know where your crown jewels are? Where are your EPHI loads, you know? I mean, so the measurements could be very easy to begin with and then go very granular down the road. I just think we need to move that ball forward because, you know, at some point there's going to be, you know, a level of accuracy required. And I think organizations today have been trying to sift through the sand, and I can appreciate that, obviously, being an organization myself. But we have to get specific. We have to understand where the data is. That's my two cents.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, so do we agree to add an item on here around accountability, and we can further refine that as what we want to call it?
Yeah, I like that.
You call it the accountability finder.
There you go. Okay, that's two items we trademarked today. We're on a roll. Okay. All right, I know we're getting closer to time. We've got about 5 minutes. Do we want to move on?
Yeah, we need to think about whether there's anything else that we really absolutely need to cover before we head to public comment.
All right, let's go through work plan real quick. All right, next slide. Yeah, we've talked about, so we're right now, fifth bullet point, that mid to late, I'm sorry, the September 20th item, obviously we're talking through right now, and then obviously, we're going to be scheduling another meeting here at mid-October or so, late October. We had a meeting on the books for, I believe it was Friday, the 5th, or whatever that Friday was, which
yes,
we'll be moving out by a week or two to give us some chance to do some more detailed assessment analysis and really provide more robust feedback back to this group. So that is our next step, is to have that meeting coming out. And then, of course, going forward. Kelly, anything you want to add to that?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I think what's important is that, you know, we obviously want to get this get a rough draft together by the time the holidays roll around, so that we all have a chance, all of us have a chance to kind of look through it, add to it. HITECH looks at it, adds to it. And then, you know, spring will be here right before we know it, and we'll be kicking off the next next generation of this work group sooner rather than later. So we've got to wrap up 2018 before we start 2019. So it's going to be a sprint to the finish, but it'll be fun. Next slide. All right. The next meeting is okay. So do we have this meeting scheduled October 17th?
Yeah. So that's currently scheduled for the full HITECH. Yes.
Okay. Perfect. All right. So this will be for the full HITECH one, which we will do that analysis and gap analysis presented back to them, and then of course the 14th, kind of looking at this in aggregate, and then looking at the report in January timeframe. So there's a lot of, obviously October, November going to be very busy. So there'll be a lot of emails probably flying around with ideas, like we just talked about today on the call, to get this to goal. Next slide. All right. So I think before we do this, is there any other comments that we want to make? All right. Then I think, Carolyn, if you're in agreement, we can transition to the next section.
Yep, I think so.
All right, Lauren?
Great. So at this time, we'll just open it up for public comment. Operator, can you please open the public line?
Certainly.
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Again, that is star 1 if you'd like to make a comment at this time.
Great, thanks. And then just for the record, I don't believe Chesley ever joined, so we can kind of catch him up sometime offline after this meeting. Operator, do we have any callers in the queue at this time?
Not at this time.
Okay. I know before we close the public comment period, I do just want to give a little bit of time. I know it takes folks just a few seconds to dial in. But if we do end a little bit early, Carolyn and Aaron, do you want to go back to any particular discussion item before we adjourn?
I wasn't feeling like we jumped out of anything over quickly, but certainly if Aaron wants to double back to something, or Brett or Christina, we should.
I'm good, actually. I think we did a pretty decent job of coming up with some two trademark new names and or new descriptors and some good ideas there. So I feel good.
Okay. Operator, last check. Any other callers in the queue?
No, we have none.
Okay. So with that, we'll close the public comment period. And
let me ask a good question. I see a public comment written in the chat room over here from Susan.
So the public members don't have the ability to speak. So we leave it up to the discretion of the chairs whether they would like to respond or address a question or in the public comment chat feature. But they don't have the ability to speak.
Got it. Didn't know that. Thank you. All right. Well, I think it's a decent comment here. So I'll just read it out loud and Carolyn, Brett, let me know what you guys think here. And so the thought from one of the public members was that perhaps there's an ISP task force that's focusing on the orders and results as their first priority. I think maybe that this group could come up with a meaningful metric around. And I believe this was interoperability and how, maybe leveraging some of those task forces to help us come up with what those metrics could be. And so I think that's a very fair question. As we pose it back to the HITAC, maybe the next HITAC meeting, we can ask if any of those task forces want to help us develop some criteria around things like interoperability or privacy and security or whatever. I think that's a very fair question. Carolyn, what are your thoughts? Brett, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a good point to follow up on.
I expect that at our next HITAC meeting, we'll have an update from the Interoperability Standards Priority Task Force just to kind of update the committee on the progress they've made. Those task force meetings are open to the public as well, but we'll certainly circle back to the full committee when we get a little further down the road there.
Yep, perfect. Okay.
Okay. Anything else before we adjourn?
No, good discussion. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your time today, and we'll adjourn, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.